Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
This week on Living Planet, a new project gets people out of their cars and onto their bikes in Buenos Aires.
Enjoying the public space and living it with engagement, that's the best way to start taking better care of it.
Making fuel out of methane in South Africa.
You've got your start button, you'll press it. You'll hear the dispenser telling you it's ready. And then you'll hear the clicking noise coming from the solenoid that's opening from the banks.
And a plan to import beluga whales in the US is causing controversy.
And currently we're lacking optimum age and sex distribution among the animals currently in our care, as well as the variety of genetics that we would need in order to be able to sustain the current population for decades to come.
I'm Andre Leslie. Welcome to the show. Well, it's been just a little over a month now since the end of the UN Climate Change Conference in Doha, and already the media coverage on the issue of global warming has all but dried up, if you'll pardon the pun. So it's good to know that one small group of people in Argentina have started up a unique project that is aimed at reducing people's reliance on cars and at the same time slowing down greenhouse gas emissions. It's called Masa Critica, a project from Buenos Aires that runs citywide bicycle days. The Argentinian capital is one of the most congested cities on the planet, with 3 million citizens and an extra 3 million workers each day commuting to the CBD, as well as high car usage. At the centre of Masa Critica is biking activist Mati Corwill. He hopes that over 50% of the world's urban commuters will be on bikes by 2030. Eilish O'Neill caught up with him to find out more about his project.
Mati Corwill is the 31-year-old founder of the organisation La Vida en Bici, Life on a Bicycle. Energetic and outgoing, he seems to know everyone, and he's willing to have long conversations even with strangers about his creatively painted folding bicycle. And he only frequents businesses that have bike-friendly policies. Today, he's drinking coffee in a cafe that gives free lemonade to cyclists. He arrived, of course, on his bike, on one of his 18 bikes. When Mati Corwill was 17 years old, he started riding to school. He thought it was so much fun that he and his friends started to organize bike-themed parties. But he says you don't need a party to have fun on a bicycle.
Cycling turns the city into a playground. Going from one place to the other becomes an experience you look towards to. Enjoying the public space and living it with engagement. That's the best way to start taking better care of it.
Corwill is not the only Buenos Aires resident who views biking as a way to have fun. Every month, a group of cyclists gathers in the city center to ride together. The leader of this organization calls itself Critical Mass. The group is demanding that drivers look out for bikes and that the city government construct more bike lanes. This October, there are almost 1,000 participants gathered to ride and to celebrate the organization's fourth anniversary. It's a pretty young crowd. Many of the participants are between 20 and 30 years old. Some of them wear costumes, others ring their bells as they wait for the ride to start, and others sell bike license plates that read Un Auto Menos, One Fewer Car. Masa Critica participants start their ride on 9 de Julio, blocking 6 lanes of the 18-lane avenue. Not all the car drivers who have to wait are pleased. Activist Mati Corwill says that while he feels safe riding in the city, many people do not.
I also know that that is what is stopping them from riding. You can notice how the streets aren't designed and planned for riding bikes. So even though part of our job is to encourage people to ride, it's more about changing the rules of the game.
Corwill envisions Buenos Aires and other cities around the world as places where biking is the most efficient form of transportation, where there are more bike lanes and four-way stops than car lanes and traffic lights, and where students of all ages learn how to ride safely and calmly in traffic. Building biking infrastructure isn't even that difficult or expensive, he says.
Digging 400 meters into the street to build this huge infrastructure for this wagon full of people, you know, building a subway, that's difficult. Putting bike lanes and bicycles everywhere is not. but it is a serious challenge in terms of getting society on board with you.
Colwell and Masa Crítica seem to be having some success in doing just that. 2.5 years ago, the city of Buenos Aires launched a program to build a network of bike lanes around the city and to make free bikes available for city residents to borrow. Paula Viciao, the program's director, biked everywhere when she lived in Paris, but she never biked in Buenos Aires until the city started to build bike lanes.
The first year, in 2010, we installed 35 kilometers of bike lanes. Last year, we got up to 70 kilometers. And right now, we have 94 kilometers of protected bike lanes in the whole city.
One of the thousands of people who use these bike lanes is Irene Fernandez. She's a graphic designer who rides wearing high heels and skirts, ready for her meetings. Since she lives close to the city center, it's easy for her to access a new network. She says the bike lanes make her rides a lot safer, especially when she's with her 8-year-old daughter.
Some of them have a curb, some taller, some a little shorter. This seems to me a big advance because it makes the bicyclist visible. It gives him space, and it encourages people that aren't used to biking in traffic to bike in a space where they'll be protected from cars.
Because of the new bike lanes, the number of bike trips has quadrupled in 3 years, says City of Buenos Aires program director Paula Viciao. At the same time, the number of cyclist deaths has fallen from up to 10 a year to only 3 deaths over the last 3 years. Still, back at the cafe, Mari Caldwell says there's a lot more work to be done to make the city safe for cyclists.
The issue here is not that cycling is not safe, it's that traffic is violent. Cycling isn't dangerous in itself, it's just the context and the things that happen around you that make it a challenge.
Caldwell still hopes that by 2030, more than half of Buenos Aires' residents will commute by bike. Last month, he persuaded 21 of the city's 60 legislators to sign a promise to try to make biking in the city safe, efficient, accessible, and attractive. He says it's a small investment that would have huge returns.
Cycling builds healthier cultures, healthier in so many senses, in terms of sustainability, in terms of economy, in terms of personal health. It's just a matter of, are we ready to look forward in time and take action today?
Mari Caldwell and Masa Crítica both say that cities with more bicycles are more human, less polluted, and less dangerous, and their residents are healthier and happier. Alicia O'Neill, DW, Buenos Aires.
The Masa Crítica is, of course, a unique way to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. To talk more about the general issue of climate change, we've got Professor Clement Zimmer in the studio today. He works as a climate researcher at the University of Bonn. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor, when I look at the bushfires and scorching temperatures in my native Australia, on the one hand, as well as the very mild winter that we've had here in Germany, I do get the feeling that climate change is happening. It's starting to speed up. Would you agree?
Yes, but not necessarily from these observations, because climate has been changing forever. It's not constant, but what we do observe or seem to observe is that during the last 100 years and maybe even more during the last 30, 40 years, we have an increased change of climate. We see that in the temperature records, which we now reliably, more or less reliably know for about 100 years or even more. So we had about 1 degree over 100 years, and half of that degree globally came about in the last 30 years. So there is a speed up.
That speed up, what sort of effect is that having on the planet?
Well, of course, it's getting warmer. It's getting, in the moment, warmer faster than before. Okay, and this has several effects, of course. We also have to take into account that this increase in temperature is different over the world. So it's low over the ocean, high over the continents, low over the tropics, high over the mid-latitudes and high latitudes. So this changes temperature contrasts, and this induces changes also in the atmospheric circulation. So circulation patterns are slowly changing.
When you had to name one reason for this climate change that's taking place, what would you say is the main cause?
I guess we can say, at least for these rapid changes we are experiencing over the last 50 years or so, the main cause is anthropogenic emission of greenhouse gases. This is, I guess, undebated.
Okay, and what does that mean in a daily basis? We're talking cars, we're talking trucks, public transport.
Just the emission from public transportation, from private transportation, airplanes, of course, industry a lot. Sure. And power production, of course.
Of course. Now, you say it's undebated, this as the main reason, yet there are still climate sceptics out there. I've met many of them in daily life, even here in Germany, a country that has a very strong environmental record. What do you say to them when you meet them? You must come across them as well.
Of course I do. I do it many times. I guess climate sceptics, they do not doubt about the increase of temperature, because this is now really a fact. But they doubt that the increased CO2 in the atmosphere by mankind is the main cause. What I have to tell these people is, come to my lecture. I do that in the introductory courses to meteorology, and actually some come. And after that, they know, and they won't disagree with that, because it's very simple to explain.
Can you explain it to us quickly now? I mean, is it something that one can explain
quickly?
No,
it needs an hour. It needs an hour, because it's just, maybe I can try, with more CO2 in the atmosphere, the radiation from the atmosphere, which is always there, always going downwards also to us, to the Earth's surface, is just increasing because the atmosphere becomes thicker. So it's just more radiation coming down than before. That's all. More energy, and this just heats up the lower atmosphere. Actually, we see the opposite trend in the stratosphere, where the atmosphere is cooling.
Okay.
But this can be explained. And this is very easy, and this is known for more than 100 years, actually.
What can countries do to solve the problems now facing the world? There are conventions, there are agreements trying to take place. We had the convention in Doha at the end of last year. What can countries do?
Well, this is, of course, exceeding my experience, my profession, but what can they do? Of course, they have to develop a society which does not emit additional CO2 into the atmosphere. And that's basically, I guess, an easy thing, because the energy which we need is there. The sun provides enough energy. We just have to develop the technology for that. And this is a matter of money. I guess we have other problems in the world which are more difficult to solve, actually, with overpopulation, economics. It's more difficult than climate change.
So you see a big hope, I suppose, then, in renewables like solar power.
Sure. But also, of course, we have to develop some tools to better store energy, because this is what makes the renewable energy a little bit, not so easy to employ.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
So lots of technology development is still necessary. But basically, I guess we have everything what we need already.
When we look at it on the individual basis, just to finish, what can people out there listening to the show, what can they do to minimize their greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, of course, minimize the emissions, reduce it as far as possible, because what everybody puts now in CO2 in the atmosphere keeps in the system for hundreds of years. So everything you do not put in the atmosphere reduces climate change. So don't use your car. Don't fly into vacation necessarily. Use, like me, your bicycle to go to work and back. It also keeps you healthy. So there are many things you can do. Just think about, when you do something, if it does emit additional CO2, and you can save a lot.
Little things that can make a difference. Professor, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Many see the key to reducing greenhouse gases in not just using more green energy sources like solar and wind, but also in the active replacement of fossil fuels in the transport industry. In Johannesburg, a new pilot project is starting up which sells the methane gas produced by rotting garbage at waste disposal dumps as fuel for cars. This unique biomethane isn't just meant to be more environmentally friendly. It's cheaper than regular petrol as well. Richard Fuchs was there and brings us this report.
Jeffrey never did like the sound of fuel being pumped into his minibus taxi. It was always an expensive experience. That's now history. Jeffrey fills up with methane gas and the fuel is cheap. He does it at one of Johannesburg's most unusual filling stations, located high on top of the East Rand landfill site. The 29-year-old is participating in the joint German-South African Energy Research Project, which produces biomethane from landfill gases.
Most of the times I can spend close to 2,000 something with the petrol for the whole week. But with the gas, it's less than 2,000 something. It's close to 1,600. Yeah, so I can save close to 700 to 800 with a week. When you drive with the gas, you can see the difference with the petrol. You see? Yeah, so those different, it's a big difference. The petrol is too expensive.
The biomethane fuel is produced in several steps, from gas that is captured from deteriorating waste products. Although he had to convert his vehicle to burn the gas, Jeffrey says the investment has already paid off. Jeffrey has Eddie Cook, the technical director of Novo Energy in Johannesburg, to thank for his fuel saving up to 30%. Cook's company is testing the pilot system in collaboration with the University of Johannesburg and a group of German research institutes. He shows us how the pump works.
You've got your start button. You'll press it. You'll hear the dispenser telling you it's ready. And then you'll hear the clicking noise coming from the solenoid that's opening from the banks. Then you turn the valve and it starts filling. You basically got three banks. A high bank, medium bank and a low bank. Your low bank has got your larger volume that will basically be filling most of the cylinder. Then you've got your medium bank that will be topping it up. And then your last bank is just that last bit of gas, just to get it up to full pressure, so that you make sure that you get enough gas in and that you got the vehicle up to 100% full.
The new technology taps into a South African shortcoming, the lack of large-scale waste separation. The country's waste disposal sites are full of different types of waste, which is broken down by bacteria and produces various gases. In addition to methane, the gases include carbon dioxide and nitrogen, as well as smelly hydrogen sulfide. Combined, they create a dirty and strongly vaporous gas cocktail that, thanks to the new technology, can now be converted into biomethane. The methane content must be 87% for biomethane to be usable as fuel for natural gas-powered vehicles. That's a level that Eddie Cook's pilot facility already far exceeds. Edison Muzenda, a professor for chemical engineering at the University of Johannesburg and a partner of the research project, sees a future for biomethane fuel in the city's public transport networks.
The actual changes that can happen in terms of transport is public transport, which is our main target, public transport and government vehicles. As you know, the cost of public transport in South Africa is very, very high. So with this use of bio-waste, biogas in particular, studies have been done economically, and we are confident that we can reduce transport costs, social costs, maybe by 30% and so forth. That would be a very, very good contribution if we can cut down on costs for the poor population.
In the coming years, Eddie Cook hopes to see up to 5% of all vehicles in South Africa powered by biomethane produced from waste. Although methane is considered a climate-altering greenhouse gas, he says it can be used safely too.
If methane is released without actually combusting it, it is negative affecting to the ozone, but we actually use the energy value of the methane, combust it in a controlled environment inside a vehicle's engine, and by that using the energy of the methane is then changed over to CO2 and water, which is the combustible products of the methane, which is not as harmful as the methane itself.
Meanwhile, Jeffrey's minibus taxi is now almost filled up and ready to roll.
It's pressurized up to 210 bars on the cylinder itself. Now you'll hear some beeping noises as soon as it jumps over to a second bank.
the Johannesburg local says he now has no intention of returning to petrol.
After 5 years, 80% of the people, they will see how the gas to work, and then they will see how are we saving. So 80% of them, they will be filling the gas.
Okay. I hope you're right. Okay, take care, Jeffrey.
I'm right, I'm 100% sure. I'm telling you, it's the fact. It's the fact. I know.
Jeffrey's ambitious usage rates are unlikely to be met in the short term, especially because not everyone can afford to get their car refitted to run on biomethane. Still, he's convinced of the future of his unique product.
Richard Fuchs there, reporting on a new fuel making a difference in South Africa. Now, time for something completely different. Did you pick the animal? That's the beluga whale. A current plan to import 18 of these unique bowl-headed white creatures for aquariums in the United States is drawing fierce opposition from animal rights advocates who object to their removal from the wild. The Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta has applied for the import permit on behalf of a group of marine parks, saying the aquariums need these threatened Arctic whales for captive breeding efforts, research and education. The decision on the application is currently pending. In the meantime, discussion on the issue is heating up. Michael Scaturo has more.
The Georgia Aquarium in Atlanta is one of the largest of its kind in the world. With over 60 exhibits, each carefully maintained, some of the water tanks are mind-blowingly large. The huge facility is geared towards kids and families. Kids and the young at heart can even crawl into some of the animals' habitats.
So I'm going to crawl into a tunnel here. Outside the tunnel are some African penguins. Let's go in. There are lots of people under here. From where you can see the underground tank where the penguins are.
There's also a dolphin show featuring Broadway-style singing and dancing, and of course, dolphins performing tricks.
AT&T welcomes you to Dolphin Tales.
Megan Gibbons works in public relations for the aquarium. She says that one of the park's most popular displays is the beluga whale tank. The display currently holds four of these unique-looking white whales, each of them about 3 meters long.
We have two that are fully grown and two that are juvenile. So you're seeing Beethoven is our largest male, and then this is Maris coming over, who's our female.
Georgia Aquarium officials are finding themselves in some hot water over plans to import 18 belugas from Russia for breeding purposes. Under the plan, the aquarium would own all of the animals, but only keep four in its facility in Atlanta. The others would be lent to aquariums around the United States. But the application for a license to import the whales has reopened a debate about the morality of keeping highly intelligent cetaceans like whales and dolphins in captivity. Georgia Aquarium manager Scott Higley says his facility performs an important educational mission.
It's so important that we have beluga whales in human care in accredited U.S. facilities like Georgia Aquarium so that we can educate the public about beluga whales.
Higley says there's still much to be learned from whales in captivity.
We know probably roughly half currently of what we need to know about beluga whales. And while we can observe the animals in their natural habitats and we can say, okay, we see what they're doing, we see their behaviors, but we can't really understand why they do what they do.
But Lori Marino, a beluga expert at Emory University in Atlanta, says the Georgia Aquarium is not conducting peer-reviewed scientific research on the belugas it already has and isn't likely to do so with the new whales that it's planning to acquire. Marino is part of a growing number of marine biologists who are philosophically against keeping cetaceans in captivity.
We need to know a lot more about belugas, but the way to do it is not to take healthy individuals from their natural habitat, plop them in a tank, and sell tickets for the public to see them.
Marino says the Georgia Aquarium and similar institutions are engaging in husbandry research. That is, they want to learn as much as possible about breeding whales more effectively. And this raises moral questions for those who believe whales should choose their own mating partners. But Higley maintains his institution is looking after the whale's best interests.
We try to look at the best potential for social groupings that would be very similar to what they would have in their natural environments. And the second thing, and this is the all-important reason, is that they'll be selected for the purposes of breeding. Because the entire reason behind this initiative is the fact that we as a zoological community in the U.S., in spite of the success I mentioned earlier, in breeding these animals, we find ourselves at a crossroads. And currently, we're lacking optimum age and sex distribution among the animals currently in our care, as well as the variety of genetics that we would need in order to be able to sustain the current population for decades to come.
The pro and anti-captivity sides are engaging in a media debate that has grabbed headlines nationwide. For example, on the issue of beluga whale lifespan, Higley says,
beluga whales in human care live as long as their wild counterparts do.
But Marino and others dispute this.
They don't live longer. They live much shorter lives. They live stressful lives, and they're dying of diseases.
Marino says data from the U.S. Marine Mammal Inventory show that whales in captivity have shorter lifespans than those in the wild and die from stress-related illnesses like bleeding ulcers.
The Georgia Aquarium lost a beluga, and she had ulcers. So you get ulcers when you're under stress.
Marino and other scientists are pushing for a complete phase-out of cetaceans in captivity. This would mean ending breeding programs and moving whales and dolphins that can't be released into the wild into sea pens, which more closely resemble their natural habitats. Though public support for freeing the whales is growing, regulators still need to be convinced, and that seems unlikely to happen quickly. Marino and others concede that the Georgia Aquarium will probably be granted its permit to import the belugas, but still, they're not going to stop campaigning for better treatment for whales. Michael Scutoro, DW, Atlanta.
And that brings us to the end of another edition of Living Planet. I'm Andre Leslie, and our technician was Jürgen Kuhn, and our in-studio producer was Eliana Giliducci. We'll be back next week with more news and stories about the environment. In the meantime, you can find us online at www.dw.de/environment. Or you can find us on Twitter. Just search for DW_eco with the hashtag LivingPlanet. We look forward to having your company next week. Bye for now.
Things are gonna change, and not for better. Don't know what it means to me, but it's hopeless, hopeless. Gotta get you home, could be with anyone. I think of what I've done, you know it all. Everything is everything. The more I talk about it, the less I do control. Everything means everything. Can't understand a word. I'm fucked up, stubborn, saying the things I do possess, sometimes they own me too. What they're gonna do to me? I think it's hopeless, hopeless. What I can't explain, I'm sure you get it well. Since I always wanted you. Everything is everything.